We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour, we'll be talking with Lok Su about his memoir, I Love Yous Are for White People. It's published by Harper Perennial. It's a book that's been out now for a couple of years. He writes in this book about his experiences. He grew up in Vietnam, was born in Vietnam. He came to the United States with his family when he was young, when he was five. Yeah. They settled in Los Angeles in the inner city. And in this book, he writes about his experiences growing up, about a lot of the adversity he faced, which he says was particularly tough, both at home and out in the street. And a lot of the book is about his relationship with his father. And later, years later, when about the time when he was going to become a parent, he started writing about his childhood, and he produced this memoir. And the title is a quote from his father, and we'll talk more about that as we get things started here and tell you about the circumstances under which his dad said that, I love you, sir, for white people. He's visiting the campus. This visit here is sponsored by the folks at the Asian American Cultural Center, and he will be giving a talk as part of a series they call Food for Thought. This is a series of lunchtime discussions. They take place at noon at the Asian American Cultural Center, so people on the campus certainly should feel welcome if they'd like to stop by. Lok Su has a PhD in industrial organizational psychology. He is vice president of marketing for TalentSmart. That's a global think tank and management consulting firm. He makes his home in San Diego, and we're pleased that he could be here and talk with us this morning. As we talk, questions, comments are welcome. People want to call in, join the conversation. You can do that, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like, you can also send us an email, and that address is will-talk, just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Dave, for having me.
I'm sure that when people talk to you about the book, often the place they want to start is with the title. and they say, you know, tell me that story of that time that your dad said to you, I love you, sir, for white people.
Yes. You know, growing up here as a Vietnamese immigrant refugee, you know, you can just imagine the culture shock that my family, especially me, felt during the time when we first arrived here in America, and especially Hollywood, California, of all places, Sunset in the heart of Sunset Boulevard. So I was very confused and frustrated because of the cultural difference that I had to deal with, you know, inside the house, and it was so different what was going on inside the house and what was different out in the streets. And growing up, I would love to watch episodes in our on our black and white TV shows like The Brady Bunch, Leave It to Beaver, Different Strokes. And the thing that really caught my attention was how these fathers would treat the sons. You know, like Mr. Drummond would be a certain way to Arnold and Willis in Different Strokes. Mm-hmm. Words like, I love you, son. I forgive you for these mistakes that you made. And by the end of the show, everything's okay. But in my household, you know, the reality was it wasn't the case. My father was a really hard father. He went through a lot growing up as an orphan. So growing up, I yearned for that affection. And then where this title came from was I had an epiphany after spending Christmas Eve dinner at a friend's house. My friend Art and his parents invited me to a Christmas Eve party. And when I was there, now this is not on TV now, this is real life. Mm-hmm. I was so fascinated by the way Art's father treated him. It was just exactly like on TV. Son, I love you. Merry Christmas. I got you the biggest present ever because you've been such a good boy this year. And so I thought to myself, like, you know, the reason why your father is so strict and so stiff is because you never used those words to him, right? So I decided that night to run home and use these three words with him, hoping that he would be like Art's father and return those three words to me. And that's what I did. I walked home. He was in the living room reading his paper and smoking his cigarette. And got up the nerve and said, "Pa, I have something to tell you." He's like, "What?" "I love you, Pa." Then he stopped for a minute. Then I said it again because his facial expression was confused. You know, what are these words coming out of my son's mouth? And I said it again, "Pa, I love you." Then something flipped inside his head. He got right into my face, slapped me a couple of times, point his index finger really hard into my forehead, and he made me promise him to never use those weak words again, because in my household, especially in the Asian culture, you don't use those weak words to express anything you're feeling. If you love me, you show me. Don't ever use those weak words to me ever again, because I love yous, those three words, are for white people. And that broke my heart.
Well, if you were a person who was lucky enough to grow up in a family that was maybe a little bit more like the ones you were watching on TV, I'm sure that a lot of people, when they read that story, they're just stunned, yes. And they can't believe it. And they ask you to tell the story, and then I'm sure they say, "Really?
Right.
Really?"
Right.
And what really strikes me is I have this feeling that probably a lot of Asian Americans, mm-hmm. they hear that story, or they hear that your dad said, "I love you," for white people, and they sort of say, "Yeah, big news." You know, they sort of say that's no news to,
right.
to me. That's I know that guy because my dad was that guy.
Right. This is no news, and you know, some even don't get the point why I use this title. It's like, you know, there's nothing new to us. You know, you shouldn't even talk about it. Mm. It's a given by the way we were raised. You know, you express your gratitude and your love in a different manner through actions. Actions like, I don't know, taking your, you know, Asian parents invest so much time and energy and money to raise their kid, hoping that when they get old, that investment will return and their children will in turn take care of them. So, you know, I told it, you know, as a father now, I can see where my father was coming from. But, you know, the approaches were wrong, and the cultural differences has a lot to do with his thinking. And, you know, many immigrants who arrived here in America were quick to assimilate and adapt to the Western culture. But in my dad's case, he's really stubborn, you know. The old man just won't change. He just won't change.
Well, I read that maybe a couple of years ago, at least, he expressed some regret. I don't know how exactly he said it. He probably did not say, "I'm sorry about, you know, whatever." But maybe he finally said, well, something like, maybe that wasn't the best thing to do.
Right. It was a Thanksgiving get-together with the whole family. And he in the middle, well, after dinner, he was outside smoking a cigarette, and he came in and said, "Lack, I need to talk to you. Why don't you come outside? Let me talk to you about something." So we were in the front yard at my sister's house, and this is after the fact that he knew that I wrote this book. He doesn't know the details in the book, but he gets the gist about how I describe his child rearing methods. And so he said, I really regret that one incident. These are his exact words. "I shouldn't have done what I did to you that one time when I threw you out of our apartment in Hollywood butt naked." Yeah. So he did not say, "I am sorry for what I did. That was wrong." He said, "I shouldn't have done that." But I get the old man. That's the best he could do. Mm-hmm. You know, now as an adult, I can read. I've learned to read between the lines of, you know, what my father says to me. And that's the difficulty of our communication style. He's never direct. Mm-hmm. That's being weak to him. To show affection and to feel guilty for what a father, quote unquote, should raise his children. Yeah.
This whole issue of parenting in Asian American homes caused a little bit of a stir not all that long ago. People maybe remember it wasn't all that long ago. Amy Chua.
Yes.
She published this book about her experiences as a mom and how she raised her daughters, The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. And she wrote a piece that was published in the Wall Street Journal and got a lot of attention and caused an awful lot of conversation. Mm-hmm. And I know that you have written about it as well. That is about what she said and about the reaction to it. I read that you, when the piece came out in the Wall Street Journal, mm-hmm. you got 1,000 emails from people, I'm sure, saying have you seen this?
Right.
What do you think about this? And there was generally discussion about, you know, is that the way to raise kids or not?
Right.
Was it with particularly among Asian Americans? Was there a lot of conversation about was that good, bad? Should she actually have written that? Was there a lot of conversation about how kids are raised?
Yes, definitely, especially amongst the second and third generation Asian American. You know, they're westernized now, so. But with first generations and 1.5 generation immigrants, it hit close to home, put it that way. Mm. When I first read the Wall Street Journal that Amy Chua wrote, I had a small episode of traumatic stress syndrome disorder. A flash came over me. Flash of anxiety came over me, disappointment and memories. Then I asked myself, this woman is educated. You know, I would understand if she wasn't, but this lady is educated. She should know better. So I thought about it, and all the hoopla within the Asian American community, persuaded me to write a piece, an opinion piece, as a rebuttal. And I said, okay, why not? Why not? I do have a point of view about this, and an opinion about this. So I wrote a piece, and CNN picked it up and exposed my side of my point of view. Mm-hmm. Basically, what I said in that piece is that, you know, the way Amy Chua defines success is different by the way most people define success. I believe the reason why Amy Chua raised her children like she does is because She was raised the same way, and she, I wouldn't say never, but disregard the emotional and psychological damage that the tiger technique can do to your children. Even though her daughters might not voice their opinion about how they really feel about the way she disciplines them, perhaps maybe they were trained to keep their mouth shut, just like my father did to me. Mm. So, you know, my conclusion about this whole opinion piece was that, you know, on paper, I might come across as a successful professional now, black suit. But emotionally, in reality, I still carry those wounds and pains that was inflicted on me by my father's tiger technique. You know, Amy Chua did not physically abuse her daughters, not that we know of. But emotionally, she has, I believe, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I got it worse. I got it both. And, you know, all these accolades and accomplishments that I was able to get don't feel like a success to me, David. Because I was brainwashed as a child. I was told as a child that I was stupid, that I was retarded, that I was a waste of space.
Do you think that your dad believed that, or that he somehow thought by telling you that then you would work really hard to prove that you were not any of those things?
Right. I think there's two elements here. The first one, to answer your question, I think there's part of that. It's called reverse psychology, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The second element to that is that he became, as soon as he arrived here in America 3 years later, he became, he had this infection in his pancreas, and the surgeon took his pancreas out and placed him on permanent disability, so he was no longer able to work. His dream was to bring his family here, you know, dodge the communists, or else he would have been dead if he's dead, to make a new life here in America for his family. That was his goal, leave, because he was a very wealthy man in Vietnam, so he had to leave all that to start brand new in America. And he said, as long as I have my two hands, I will make it again here in America, because hard work does that. But he became ill, and, you know, his life took a turn. His sense of worth took another turn. And so that affected him psychologically, mentally, behaviorally. And, you know, this is another issue within the Asian American community, is that we don't know how to communicate. Well, let me say this better. We communicate differently. Hmm. Father do not talk to their children in a very calm, educated, and soft manner. It's like, I tell you to do this, you better do it, whether right or wrong. Okay? Control. So he didn't know how to express his disability and his loss of control within the family. So to make up for that, he became abusive. You know? So he put fear in me and the rest of the family, even though he was disabled. And he would, on average, David, I would get beaten 3 or 4 times average a week. It was brutal. And to him, I think he was trying to make this point. Even though I am disabled, I could still enforce pain into you and make sure that you still label me as the king of the household, right? So where am I going with this?
I guess that the thing I'm still, you know, you wonder about is did he think that was still, that he was doing right by you, that somehow that was going to get you to grow up to be, you know, good, upstanding, hardworking, well-educated, successful man, and that was an effective, you know, he wasn't doing it out of malice, that he was doing it because he thought that the goal ultimately for you to be a success would be achieved that way.
I believe so, yes. I believe so. He thought he was doing right. And that was the only way he knew how to.
Let me take a minute here, and we do have a call. Let me take a minute here to introduce again our guest, Laksu. We're talking about his story, his life story, a story that he tells in his memoir, I Love Yous Are for White People. It's published by Harper Perennial. And as he explained, the story was that he one day said to his dad, I love you, Pop. And then his father got very angry and said that was weak talk and said, quote, don't you ever say that again. I love yous are for white people. Mm-hmm. Laksu was born in Vietnam. He came to the U.S. with his family when he was a boy, little boy. They lived in Los Angeles, and he tells the story of some of his growing up, and a lot of the book is about his relationship with his dad. He is today working as vice president of marketing for TalentSmart. That's a global management consulting firm. He makes his home in San Diego, has a family there, and is here visiting the campus sponsored by the Asian American Cultural Center and will be giving a talk at noon today. It's part of a lunchtime discussion series they call Food for Thought, and that's at noon at the Asian American Cultural Center. So if you want to stop by, you can do that. And also you can go out and look for the book. Questions are welcome. We have somebody here ready to go, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Callers in Savoy on our line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Great show. Just absolutely fascinating. I really appreciate your guest taking the time to share all these stories. Unfortunately, I grew up in a time, 50s and 60s, where physical punishment, I think, was probably the norm as opposed to the exception. And I think for the most part, I think most parents hopefully have gotten away from that, but I can relate to some of those stories. Just real quickly, with your guest, I wanted to know if you could maybe give us a historical perspective. And what I mean by that is, when he came over from Vietnam, was it after the U.S. left? So was there any interface with the Communist Party that took over, or did he leave prior to the United States? I mean, I just remember as a child that being an extremely hectic time, and the Khmer Rouge and Cambodia and all that, those unbelievable stories. And then I was wondering, number one, if the father, his father was still living, what prompted their leaving Vietnam, and if he had any stories he wanted to relate culturally in Los Angeles with either the white or the black or Latino cultures that he experienced. Great show. I'll ring off. Thanks.
All right, thanks. Well, that would give us enough for another couple hours. I appreciate the questions the caller asked, so maybe we'll take a couple of steps back and talk a little bit about how it is that your family came to the United States.
Right. It was after the fall of Saigon, after 1975, but we didn't leave right after that. We left in 1978. The first wave of Vietnamese refugees that had to do whatever it takes to get out of there. my father's head was wanted by the communists. Number one, because he was a businessman, very successful businessman back then. He owned a couple of Home Depot type of warehouses. Number two, because he was half Chinese. And number three, he fought along U.S. troops against, during the Vietnam War against the Communist Party. So those are three strikes against them. One strike, maybe, you know, they sent you to re-education camp. Two strike might be some tortures and stuff like that. But three strike, they want you dead. So my father had three strikes on him. Mm. He knew he had to leave, do or die. He had to leave. And, you know, he gave up everything, bought a fishing boat, at least I would say 300 yard fishing boat, but he stuffed over 500 people in that boat. So we left. We ran to the. I remember vaguely the day that we left. You know, the chapter one, titled "The Wrong Way Home." Most of that chapter, I gathered information from my father because I was quite young at that time to really recall what really happened. I remember it was a rainy day. The storms were coming in, and my father said, "Run towards the boat. Everybody run towards the boat." So there were communist soldiers behind the jungles and behind the trees and such, shooting machine guns at us as we run towards the boat, throwing grenades. At first, I thought they were thunders. And then, you know, a couple of feet away, there would be like explosion with the sand coming all over our faces and such. But my father said, "Do not stop. Run towards the boat." So we were fortunate enough to get out of there, and then a typhoon came in. So we were stranded in the ocean for 3 nights, 4 days, and there was 3 boats who left that day. 2 of them sank, and then ours was the last one, and it began to leak. We were going down. We were going down. And my father was ready to die, and I remember him wrapping a soaked blanket around my mother, myself, and my little sister Kui, you know, in the belly of the boat, sitting there, ready to die, ready to go down together. And then someone up in the boat yelled out, "We see a light! We see a light!" So my father ran up there, and luckily a Hong Kong naval cruiser was there. They were docked because it was a typhoon. They're not going anywhere, so they just docked there. But they found us. So everybody came up and tried to call for help. They couldn't see us, and when they flashed the floodlight on us, they told us, "What are you guys doing out here in the middle of the ocean during a typhoon? This big Navy ship right here wouldn't even dare to move, but you with this rickety fishing boat, what are you doing here? We're Vietnamese refugees. Our boat is sinking. Our boat is sinking. Please help us. Please help us." Now, it was against the law, the Hong Kong government law, to pick up any refugees. So my father, with his quick thinking, told everyone to raise their children, pick them up, and show them, show the soldiers the children, hoping that they'll sympathize with that and, you know, change their mind. And it worked. So in a loudspeaker, the captain said, "Only children." And as soon as the naval soldiers threw down their rope ladders, guess who was the first one up? all the men. And then my father was the first one up, and he demanded, you know, he talked to the captain. He made an offer. You know, some of these refugees brought gold and jade and diamonds with them. We would give everything, I'm going to tell everybody on this boat to give that up if you can save us. And he thought about it for a minute. These are all the things that my father has told me. I mean, I don't remember, right? I was only five years old. And so something, you know, touched the captain's heart. And he said, all right, save everybody. I have to deal with this later. Save everybody, and you guys could keep your gold and your... And while we were up there, our boat went down. Miracle number one. There was a bunch of miracles during this lifetime of mine. And I'm only 35 years old, David.
Well, forgive me for making you jump ahead, though.
Mm-hmm.
How did you ended up some time later then coming to the United States and settling in Los Angeles, which was not, you know, people... Forever, people have thought about America as being the promised land. Gold Mountain, that's
sure.
What, you know, that was the idea. It was a place people were going to come
sure.
and make their fortunes and live the way that they would like. Well, for your family, when you settled in L.A., it wasn't like that.
It wasn't the case. I mean, we were fortunate enough to be sponsored by a Buddhist organization, but that, I mean, financially, there was only so much that they can offer, so... we applied for government assistance, and we were fortunate to get some help there. And you know, my father would try to find, you know, menial work to start with, and he started as a chef assistant, you know, in Chinatown, and became ill, and you know, the American dream that he had envisioned while he was in Vietnam, you know, getting ready to leave, was shattered. We were placing the projects of L.A., you know, but we didn't know any better, Dave. We didn't know any better. This is America. We have a roof over our head, and we have food. That's all we needed. It was better than living in Vietnam after the war. That's what my father said. It'll be okay. To answer your caller's question about the term white people, my father considered white people anyone who wasn't Asian. So it's not white in terms of Caucasian white, right?
So Latinos, they're white people.
They're white people. African American, they're white people. If they're not Asian, they're white people. It's like the in-group, out-group sort of thinking. If you're not among one of us, you're them. You're white. I just want to make that clear.
Yeah.
A lot of that has to do with his thinking about the inner and outer cultural divide between the Asian and who else that are in America.
So you came to the United States. You spoke Chinese and Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. You didn't speak English.
No English.
When you went to school, mm-hmm. you started meeting other kids.
Mm-hmm.
What was that early experience like?
Oh, David. Weird. Because in Vietnam, I was so used to other kids looking like me, same height and whatever. When I went to kindergarten, when I started school in Hollywood, my first day of school, I was so scared, you know. I've never in Vietnam seen a kid or a person with dark skin. So when I saw a Puerto Rican or a Dominican or an African American, I just thought they were ghosts. It's like, whoa, very confused, right? And some were taller than I was, some were heavier than I was, and some had strange hair textures than I did. So, and they would speak the language that I wasn't familiar with. So it was a very confusing time, you know, the first, I would say, 2-3 years when I started school. Strange time.
So tell me about your. I hate again. I'm sorry. I'm really jumping around here, but you got involved in some gang activity.
Yes.
And I guess it happened for the reason a lot of kids get into gangs, mm-hmm. because they're looking for family, mm-hmm. what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And so you went looking out on the street.
I went looking out on the street, yes. So on Sunset Boulevard, you know, around my neighborhood, it was predominantly Latino. And my neighbor right next door were in a gang. So, you know, when my pa let me out to play for a little bit, I went straight next door because there was a guy my age, they call him Frog. He was my age, so, you know, I befriended him. So I was around that gang lifestyle a lot growing up. And I felt like I needed to leave the house. It was a suffocating environment for me to be in. So I was always happy to hit the streets. And it was weird because, you know, in retrospect, of course, it was weird because here is a Latino gang family that took this little Vietnamese boys in as one of their own. And I would, you know, try to be like them. And you, gang members love to wear baggy clothes and such. So I didn't have, my parents didn't have money to buy me baggy Levi's or even Levi's. So the closest I was able to look like them was I went into my pa's closet and took out the biggest pair of bell bottoms and put them on and try to be like these gang members. And I would never put those kind of clothes in front of them, but, you know, I remember putting them in a plastic bag and then going outside, you know, going to their house and changing into the gang attire. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when I go back home, I would change into the home clothes and go back in. That was when I was in Hollywood. That's my first time being exposed to the gang life. And then from Hollywood, my father moved us to the Asian section of Los Angeles, the east side of Los Angeles. We call it the San Gabriel Valley, the Asian community. And the ironic thing was I had to readapt. You know, when I see other peers that were Asians, I thought they were weird because I grew up around people, friends who weren't Asian in Hollywood. So there's, you know, geographic politics there as well. Mm. But the thing with the Asian community is they did not like people outside of their culture. And I did not like, but we're talking about the gang life now. We're against gang members outside of their culture, particularly the Latinos. So I was thinking to myself, wait, when I was in L.A., Hollywood, I got along just well with these Latinos. Why are my Asian peers hating them? And this was just, I would say, 60 miles away. You know, the politic changed. And vice versa. The Latino gangs did not treat me the same way as they did in Hollywood. So that was confusing. That was really confusing. It's like, okay, you know, why, you know, a week before in Hollywood, you took me as one of your own. And now, in this new location, the Asian community, you want to kill me. So that was very confusing. Mm. So as for protection, I took up the Asian gang mentality as protection. And, you know, this was during my freshman year and sophomore year in high school. And I got really, really involved in that. And that was also the time when my father was very, very, very ill. And very, very violent. He just didn't know how to cope with his illness. So he took his anger out of me all the time. And, you know, when he blows up, I didn't want to deal with it. I just left the house, hit the streets, and gangbang. Mm. For one, to get rid of my anger. And number two, you know, I just didn't want to deal with the reality of what was happening inside my household. And it got pretty bad. It got pretty bad at that moment, my sophomore year in high school.
We got about 10 minutes left here. We're talking with Lok Su.
Wow, that was quick, David.
That happens. See, you got somebody on who can tell you a good story. That happens. As he has explained here, if you were not listening earlier, he was born in Vietnam. He came to the U.S. with his family when he was 5, settled in inner city L.A., and has written about his experiences in his memoir, I Love Yous Are For White People, and it is published by Harper Perennial. He went on to go to college, got himself a Ph.D., works as a psychologist, has a PhD in psychology, and is now vice president of marketing for Talent Smart. It is a global think tank and management consulting firm. He makes his home in San Diego and is visiting the campus. Questions, if somebody wants to call in here, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The book, I think, goes up until the point where you're 11, something like that, or maybe like when you're in your teens, maybe?
11th grade.
Oh, 11th, that's where I get 11, 11th grade, not right. That you were 11.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So you were in high school
mm-hmm.
at that point.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, how it is that you started to sit down and finally write this, and was it in fact that you were, when you were going to be a parent yourself, mm-hmm. that's what really started you down the road of going back, trying to relive this, think about it, process it, and that's why you ended up writing the book?
Yes. A lot had to do with my background with psychology, you know, learning the benefits of, you know, well-being and psychology and emotional intelligence. But the main reason why I decided to write this book was because my wife was expecting our first daughter at that point. you know, and for some reason, it is really weird when you know that you're going to be a father. You think about, well, this is in my case, I thought about death a lot for some reason. Like, what would happen to my daughter, to my family, if something would have happened to me? And I know that the experiences and the stories that I have written in this book is an heirloom. It's an heirloom. And, you know, my father has passed down these stories to me, you know, as father. And, you know, I appreciate that greatly. And, you know, I thought that, I believe that as to be a responsible father, you know, you have to, you know, preserve these stories of where you came from, and you know, make sure that, you know, it's passed down for generations. So, you know, that question of what would happen, where would these stories go if I didn't write it, and if something would have happened to me. And I wrote this book during a time when I was writing my dissertation from a PhD. That's how important it was.
You're doing both those things at the same
time?
At the
same time, yeah. It was insane. Yeah, so that's the main reason, David.
I'm sure that a lot of people, a lot of guys, when they're on the verge of being a dad, and they think about what that means, and I guess it depends on what kind of dad you had, mm-hmm. that some people would say, either they'd say, I want to be just like my dad, mm-hmm. or they would say, I don't want to be nothing like my dad. I mean, did you think a lot about him and the kind of father that he was, and did you find yourself saying to yourself, no matter what happens, I am not going to do it like that?
Yes. I made that promise to myself when I was younger, when I was going through these horrible experiences. Mm-hmm. It's like I knew what pain felt like, and I told myself if I was a father, I don't want to inflict the same type of pain to my children. I made myself a promise, do whatever it takes. But the strange thing is, you know, those behaviors are passed down onto you, whether you like it or not. You know, it's ingrained. It takes effort for me these days, David, to not behave the way my fathers behave. I tell people it's in my blood, you know. Mm. I've been brainwashed to be that way. So that my struggle these days is to be aware when anger or frustration comes about and make sure I process that in the moment, walk away from it. And it's tough. You're talking about in the moment stuff here. When you get, you know, so angry, the first thing that I was taught is to lash out. So it takes effort. It takes mm-hmm. effort. But let me say one thing, though. I think my father meant well. Of course, what father doesn't want, you know, the best for his son? I've learned so much from the old man. He's a wise and intelligent man. But under the circumstances that life has dealt him, you know, growing up as an orphan, make it on his own in Vietnam, and immigrated here to America with nothing and promised to make it again, and was unable to. So all those factors made him the way he is. And from writing this book, I got to understand that. Mm. You know? I think that if I didn't write this book, and if it wasn't for my psychology degree, I think, you know, a lot of these stories would be kept deep inside of me, suppressed, and could be really dangerous if I didn't dig it up and try to deal with it.
A caller asked a question about your dad. Your dad's still alive.
Yes.
So he's seen you with your kids, mm-hmm. and the way that you behave with them. Mm-hmm. What do you think he thinks when he sees you and the kind of dad that you are?
That I'm white. You've become white now, son. I mean, I'm hoping that, well, I'm showing him that there's a better way to treat your children, to raise your children. He walks away when I kiss my children and when I hug them and when I tell them, thank you, I love you, I'm sorry. He just walks away. I'm pretty sure he's paying attention, but he doesn't want to be around that. But the strange thing is, David, that he treats my grandchildren totally different by the way he treated me. He plays with my grandchildren, his grandchildren, you know, pinches their cheek, sniffs them. To Asians don't kiss, they sniff. Mm-hmm. Sniffs them in the cheeks, you know, ruffle their hair, tell them how cute they are. Why didn't I get some of that? That is the strangest thing.
Yeah, see, that I don't know that that's so odd, maybe. You know, when people become grandparents, it's like their second chance.
You think that's a good point.
And I think that sometimes people really do do things. And plus, you know, when you're a grandparent, like, you're not exactly responsible.
Right.
The kids go home. You don't have to live with them 24 right. hours a day.
That's right.
So it's a different deal. And there is an odd sort of intergenerational alliance. The two groups, the old ones and the young ones, they get to line up against the ones in the middle. And that's you.
Right.
See? That's you. So your parents and your kids get to gang up on you.
Right.
And I think that they enjoy that. So I think that's kind of part of the deal of being a grandparent.
Right, right.
Not that I would know anything about that, of course. Well, we're kind of at the point, almost the point where we have to stop. It's really, I know a lot of people have been very moved by your story. And I know also, I think people are kind of curious whether you're going to continue to write and write about your life. You know, sort of that next stage of your life.
Yes, I'm currently doing that right now. I have seven chapters in, but I haven't decided whether I should take the prequel route or a sequel route, because I really want to tap into my grandfather's story. I talked about it a little bit in this book, my first book, but, you know, now that my father's still alive, I want to pick his brain a little bit about his father, and I want to learn where all this root cause is coming from. That's one approach I want to take the next book, or continue where I left off with this book.
So you would never have met your grandfather, or did you?
No, no. He passed away when my father was 12. So yeah. You know, yeah.
Okay. Well, if for people who are interested in reading more of the story, and it's a good story, I would certainly recommend you look for the book, Laksu's memoir. The title of his book is I Love You, Zohar, for White People, and it is now out in paper. It's published by Harper Perennial, so you can look for it in the bookstore, the library. I also want to mention that he is here in Champaign-Urbana visiting. His visit is sponsored by the Asian American Cultural Center, and he will be talking in a lunchtime discussion series that they have that they title Food for Thought. And this takes place at noon, from noon to one, at the Asian American Cultural Center on the campus, and I'm sure that anybody who was interested should feel welcome to attend. And hey, thanks a lot very much.
Thank you for having me, David.